Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Seb Stafford-Bloor from TIFO Football, and Adrian Clark, the tactical analyst. Okay, let's start with the obvious. Liverpool will still win the Premier League. Don't read anything into the neutered version of the Merseyside derby. Of all the games since the restart, I hated it. Stripped of passion, it became a bloodless, soulless exercise. I'm tempted to look forward to next season, and maybe Chelsea. They've got a 5-point cushion in fourth place at the moment, and obviously play Manchester City later in the week. But there's a sense of a club refocused and in the process of being regenerated. Saeed, is the Empire ready to strike back?
They're looking good, got to say. Yeah, if I were a Chelsea fan, I'd be pretty excited about the future. They've made a statement, haven't they, by flexing their muscles in the transfer market, by bringing in Timo Werner, and before that, Hakim Ziyech, very exciting player from Dutch football. So two signings to get the juices flowing, the kind of football that supporters want to see. A lot of young players, again, that's a popular policy, isn't it? So no, I do feel that Chelsea are in a very good position ahead of next season. The one area that definitely needs upgrading is in defence. I still feel that at the real highest level, Chelsea have a big shortcomings at centre half and also at left back when they're not able to boss proceedings. Alonso's their best attacking left back, but he's not a great defender. So no, there are issues in defence to remedy, but they're looking good. And yeah, I think their recruitment policy is pretty sound. And Petr Cech, I think, probably deserves a bit of credit. I was looking at how they recruited Werner and Ziyech, and Petr Cech, by all accounts, was very prominent in the discussions. And doesn't it help having someone of a legendary football background in a position like that, where it's impressive? It's as simple as that. It just feels better for a potential signing or his agent to have a discussion with Petr Cech rather than a technical director that you know, never had a playing career. It can be a game changer. And I think when you couple up Cech and Lampard and you get them both on a Zoom call or a Skype call or in a hotel or however they do these things, you've got Cech and Lampard selling you the vision, selling you the club. If you're a player, it's hard to say no to that. So I think Chelsea are doing a lot of things right at the minute.
Well, that certainly happened, didn't it, with the Timo Werner signing. And, you know, obviously there's a lot of noises off, Seb, aren't there? You know, Kai Havertz has been mentioned, Ben Chilwell, because Leicester, when the price is right, will sell. And obviously you've got the homegrown talent backing all this up. Mason Mount, I thought, is really growing into his role. Ruben Loftus-Cheek, that was one of the great benefits of the win against Villa. And beyond all that, you've got Roman Abramovich, who has the wealth, even in these straitened times. Do you think he senses his chance to actually reassert the club?
Does seem like it, doesn't it, Mike? It's an aggressive Chelsea that we haven't seen for quite a long time. They've spent money in the past. They spend money during every transfer window. But I think the difference now is the type of shelf they're shopping on. You know, the type of store they're shopping in, even, because this is not one of those kind of Danny Drinkwater, Ross Barkley windows. This is taking players from the top level of European football. if it is deliberate, it's a very smart move because, you know, Chelsea obviously behaved impeccably actually through the lockdown in terms of their social responsibilities and how well they communicated. You know, whereas if some clubs came out now and spent a lot of money, I think they would rightly be facing a few questions, including my own football club, sadly. But Chelsea, you know, this is potentially a time to build some momentum at a time when a lot of other clubs will just take stock. A lot of other clubs will look inward on their squads and think, where is my unrealized potential? Where are my players that haven't potentially had enough game time to mature into a credible first teamer? Whereas Chelsea have looked outward and said, right, where are our deficiencies? And left back aside, because I completely agree with Aid there, that needs an upgrade. And, you know, if Chilwell's available, then that would be a nice option. They've noticed their deficiencies. They've addressed them quickly. And they've also, you know, because one of the oddities of this season, Mike, is going to be when we go between seasons, we're probably going to have a break of about 2.5-3 weeks. And first of all, that's not enough time to do considered transfer business. And it's certainly not enough time to integrate a new player into a first team or even a squad. You're not going to get the luxury of like a month-long tour in Asia or America or anywhere like that. So they've not only identified the right talent, they've got it done really early as well, which is super impressive given the circumstances.
Yeah, and I suppose conversely, you know, there has been some talk about outgoings. Pedro, it seems, is determined to get to Roma as soon as possible. And although Frank Lampard has denied this, there have been persistent murmurs about allowing N'Golo Kanté to leave, which frankly strikes me as daft. Do you think, Aid, that he's been misused? Because we saw again against Villa how effective he is.
We did. It was another reminder of how good he is in that deep-lying, more defensive role. But he's a very good distributor as well. He keeps it simple, doesn't he? He moves the ball, keeps things ticking over. He can do what Jorginho can do, in my opinion. I think Jorginho is actually expendable, really. He's a good player. I like a lot of what he does. Penalties are different class, aren't they, with a little skip. But if you're looking to the future, I think Conte and Billy Gilmore can more than cover that position. So I wouldn't be looking to move him on. I mean, N'Golo himself strikes me as someone that might want to keep moving. We saw that at Leicester. He's eager to get out, go to Chelsea, and maybe he sees his future somewhere else. I'm sure a lot of the global giants would be interested in N'Golo Kanté, but he's also not silly, is he? And we've just been talking about how bright we think the future might be for Chelsea with this fresh generation. And I would imagine there'll be a temptation to be a part of that. But yeah, he might want to know one way or the other if he's going to be used in his best position. Because for me, he's in the top two or three in the world in that role. As a box-to-box midfielder, I think he's perfectly effective and certainly up there in the top 10 Premier League box-to-box midfielders. But it's not his forte. So yes, in answer to your question, in a long-winded way, I think he's been misused to accommodate Jorginho. But there you go.
Yeah. Do you think, Seb, you know, we'll learn a little bit more about Chelsea on Thursday night when they've got Manchester City. And, you know, as I mentioned in the intro, they've got a 5-point cushion over Manchester United and Wolves. Do you expect them to protect that?
I do now. I mean, I think I'm being instructed by their recovery against Villa. I think that was very, very impressive. They actually dominated that first half, were unlucky to go in behind, and then quickly they turned on the power and the cohesion and overwhelmed Villa. I think we're all reading a little bit too much probably into these first games, but that's natural. It's all we've got. But that just sort of told me that the attitude is right, the focus is right, preparation has been as good as it can be. And I mean,
Depth is good as well, isn't it, Seb?
The depth is good. You know, you don't have players. Be interesting. It was interesting to see Pulisic come on, you know, having had this kind of stop-start beginning to his Chelsea career and immediately make a difference. Now, I compare that, for instance, to how ineffective Jose Mourinho's subs were for Spurs, the issues in the Man United defence. I think it's been, of all the teams competing for that kind of that fourth Champions League spot, I think it's been, you know, the most impressive. Wolves, I still don't know about, because West Ham are nothing really to a team like Wolves. You can just walk over them. But Chelsea, yeah, pretty impressive. It just seems healthy, Mike. I think the adaptation to the knowledge that, you know, Werner's coming in, Ziyech is coming in. You've seen players like Mount raise their performance immediately. And I think that's really encouraging. It speaks very highly of the culture at Chelsea more than anything else.
Yeah, and I think you've got to praise Frank Lampard for helping to sustain it, or even maybe, you know, create a new culture. You know, we mentioned Liverpool in the intro. They've got Crystal Palace next on Wednesday. Before looking at the derby, but also the implications of some of the performances in that game, just want to dwell for a second, Aidan, if I may, about Roy Hodgson's return to Anfield. Does this Palace team represent the restoration of his reputation after, you know, disappointments at Liverpool and England? When you think about it, with that squad, four straight wins, ninth, you know, Europe is even a possibility. That's a heck of an achievement, isn't it?
It is. And yeah, well, look, let's see where they finish up. There's still plenty of time for them to not fall away, I guess, from that kind of contention. But no, I'm really impressed with Palace again this season. Restoration, yeah, I think it has, because in this country, he was tarnished by the Iceland debacle, wasn't he, and his reaction to it. And he has proved all over again what a smart coach he is. He is a very good organiser. He's perfect for a team like Crystal Palace, actually. I don't think he's the guy to manage a whole bunch of flair players. I think he's the kind of manager that thrives in an underdog environment where you have to be solid. And he's created that solid defensive base. We'll talk about Arsenal later on, I'm sure. But what Arsenal lack is reliability at the back, concentration, and players that hate conceding goals. And Palace have got those. They're really, really tight as a unit. And up front, I have to say that the acquisition of Jordan Ayew has been a big hit. He's getting a tune out of Christian Benteke now. He's managed to re-motivate, regenerate him to some degree. And when you put those two alongside Zaha, that's a pretty decent unit. And behind them, you've got a very strong, energetic, powerful central midfield. So they're a team, Palace. They are absolutely a solid team that deserve their place inside the middle of the Premier League. And a lot of that is down to Hodgson.
Mm. If you look at Liverpool, Seb, I was reading a piece with Virgil van Dijk before the game on Sunday, where he was saying, look, Liverpool can get better. How?
What comes to mind immediately is Naby Keita. He has, I counted up, I somehow wrote 2,000 words on this game.
I have to say, hope your medal's in the post for that.
That's, yeah, amazing. Me too. Like, and my lack of sleep, hope that's in the post as well. I counted up his injuries since he moved to Liverpool. He's had 8 different muscular injuries, 7 muscular injuries actually, and 1 dead leg since he joined in 2018. And that kind of adds to this sense that there is obviously a player there, but just someone who hasn't quite been integrated as Jurgen Klopp might like. Now, I look at Keita and I think he has a different set of attributes and a different set of traits to everybody else in that midfield, like in terms of his ability to drive with the ball at his feet, beat players, play in tight spaces intricately. He's got lovely close control. He can finish from close range and from distance if the opportunity presents itself. So I look at him and think, if you can keep him fit and if you can define a proper long-term role for him, then you can sort of change the personality of that midfield. And that's the means by which you can possibly change the way Liverpool attack and, you know, broaden the sort of questions they're capable of asking. Everything else, I'd be really loath to touch or change. Like the fullback dynamic, you don't want to interfere with.
They really missed Robertson, didn't they?
I think they missed the existence of the tandem. They missed Robertson as an individual, but when both of those players are there, they have this kind of harmonious dynamic whereby any player in any position can switch the point of attack at any moment. And it works so well that as a defending team, it's really difficult to see it coming. How many times when you watch Liverpool do you see it look as if they have not only an extra man, but as if, you know, when they switch the ball to the flanks, they have these little mismatches which just appear from nowhere, which other teams just cannot cope with. And when you when you take one of those fullbacks away and you disrupt the partnership, that utility goes and they look so much more predictable as a result. It's really interesting. I mean, actually, it's kind of a study of how important fullbacks have become in the modern game, but also sort of how effective they are when they use that well. But Keita's the one for me, Mike. I really want to see more of him, but I want to see what Liverpool can be as a result of his evolution at the club, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it certainly does. I mean, from your perspective, Aid, how much of a worry is Mo Salah at the moment? Because it's obvious that that front three, when it's a 2+1, doesn't have the same impact.
Yeah, no, they do rely on the three of them, don't they, together. And when one is missing, and it's not just Salah, if Firmino's missing, sometimes it doesn't click as well. It doesn't fall apart, but they just seem to lose their mojo a little bit, don't they? Yeah, I think that is the next challenge, because they might not be there forever, as we've seen with a lot of teams on since Project Restart began. Players are going down for fun, aren't they? Injured, and there's a good chance that they might lose Mane, Salah, Firmino for the rest of the season and into next season potentially. So they need to have the right players to slip in. And Minamino, as talented as he is, you know, he's lively, he's a good technical player. Not quite up to, he's not up to their level at the moment. And they were imbalanced, weren't they, without him. I always feel as well that as excellent as Firmino is, having a different option, maybe a more traditional centre-forward available that can still chip in with goals and offer the kind of link play that Salah and Mane require. I still think that is a hole in their squad. So for me, if they're to do one piece of business, I would suggest they should get a centre forward that's of a slightly different, not a target man centre. Do you know who they should get? And we'll probably get to him later. Someone like Raul Jimenez, a target man that can offer a threat in behind, something a little bit different to Firmino and be really physical inside the box, but also someone that can drop in like he does and link play comfortably. I think Raul Jimenez would be among my list of targets if I was Klopp. But we'll see on that one.
Let's guarantee a volley for some Wolves fans, because I actually think I'd love to see Adama Traore in that team.
Well, he would be the ideal fill-in, wouldn't he, for Salah or Mane? But I mean, Traore is just purring, isn't he? I mean, it's just it was almost embarrassing. Like what we saw when he came on against West Ham, he was so much better than the defenders that he was up against. He could literally do whatever he wanted to do. He was a joy to watch in that cameo sub appearance.
It was like watching a man play against under 14.
He was like, yeah, second half.
Delight is the right word as well, Aid. He's just a joy at the moment. The way he's evolved and the kind of, I mean, at his best, how easy he makes the game, how easy it makes it look to just to go past Premier League level defenders. It's incredible.
Yeah. Well, he's almost, against a tiring team especially, he's pretty much unplayable, isn't he? And I also think his development has to be a testament to Nuno's coaching ability, doesn't it?
It does. Also a testament to Tony Pulis's coaching ability, because Pulis is probably the first one to recognise that Traore had been mismanaged prior to his arrival at Middlesbrough, and that he kind of been treated as a blunt instrument. But yeah, I mean, since he arrived at Wolves, the evolution has been amazing. I mean, if you think back to his original transfer, there are people, myself included, who thought, yeah, 18, 90 million, that's probably a little bit too much for him. And now, can you imagine what he would cost on the open market? If you say like that he'd be suited to Liverpool, Mike, can you imagine how much they'd have to come up with to take him away from Wolves? It'd be 60, 70.
What I love about the way Nuno has guided him is the discipline to the game and keeping things simple. Clearly, they've worked really hard on his decision-making and end product inside the final third. It just stands out that he's a more intelligent footballer now than he was previously. So I think Nuno deserves a lot of credit for that. But also, what Nuno hasn't done that some managers might fall into the trap of doing is inflate Traore, inflate his ego, because he's been so brilliant. Yet we haven't heard a peep, really, out of Nuno. He hasn't bigged him up. He hasn't said, he's kept his feet firmly on the ground and limited the praise that he said publicly about him. And I think that's smart. And he's also backed that up with actions. He doesn't always pick Adama Traore because he puts the team first, and he sees him often as someone that can change the dynamic of a game in the second half. And he won't, even if he's not 100% fit, he won't automatically play him like some managers would when you've got a player as devastating as Traore. So I think his handling of him has been deeply impressive.
You know what's also really interesting, guys, is that with that kind of player, I think some managers would have said, right, how can we simplify your role? So you have an Adama Traore type, and you say you're going to be limited to playing right on the touchline. You beat your fullback and you put in a cross. Whereas actually, the opposite has happened. He's encouraged him in field, which is really, and he's thrived as a result. His play in the middle third of the pitch, that second goal on Saturday, is a perfect example. You wouldn't have found him in that area previously.
But also, the scorer of that goal, a spectacular goal, Pedro Neto, here's someone who's only 20, probably another product of the Mendes pipeline, if you like. Wolves have got a real team developing, and they're almost too good for their own good at the moment, because simply, people are going to look at this team and think, well, I'll have him, or I might even have him, or even him. And you've got really good players who are almost going unnoticed. Someone like Willy Bolly at the back. He looks a terrific defender.
I think Willy Bolly is outstanding. He's definitely one of the most underappreciated defenders or players, really, in the Premier League. He would enhance, I think, most of the so-called big six, and Leicester, if you're going to chuck them into the mix. He would enhance all of them. I think he's good enough to get into their starting 11. So, look at Arsenal and Spurs in particular, and he would walk into their teams. But Wolves might be in the Champions League next year. If City's European ban is upheld for 1 year at least, I think they've got a real, real good shot of finishing fifth this season, Wolves. And if that happens, then that team will surely stay together. You're right about Neto as well. I think he's a really promising, exciting young player that we don't know a lot about, but I think we're about to find out a lot more about him, because that was a great goal. And what impressed me about Wolves in this game was their patience, because West Ham's tactics were so blatant in terms of, we're going to be incredibly deep, and we are not, because we're a bit slow anyway, we're not going to expose ourselves here and let you run right on the counter. And they didn't panic, Wolves, and they eventually just ground them down with a bit of quality, mixed up their formation and personnel, and in the end, that a couple of moments of real quality made the difference. And I think it will give them confidence moving forwards, Wolves, because it wasn't just about being on the counter here. They had possession, and they, what we saw with the goal, particularly the Doherty cross for Neto, was when teams sit deep and we have to find a way to open them up, We do have the quality, and we'll just put balls in the box, and we trust our forwards to finish them. And that's what we saw actually with both the goals, didn't we? With Jimenez and Neto. So yeah, really good team, Wolves. But as Seb rightly pointed out, they didn't beat a great deal, did they, in West Ham?
Mm. Do you think, let's look at Manchester United, Seb, if we could, who are obviously the natural rivals for fourth or fifth. Specifically, the impact of Bruno Fernandes. He seems to be the missing link. Is that fair?
Yeah, it's just provided them with a completely different layer of creativity. That ball into, I think it was Anthony Martial, where Eric Dier made the last ditch block. I mean, what, there's lovely disguise on that pass. A, to play it and to see the option. B, to hide it from all the players around the ball. And just, I mean, I went the wrong way and I was sitting at home watching on TV. I think, I'd want to mention Paul Pogba as well. I'll tell you what, Ed, you've played. That cut half volley pass. Okay, so you come back after, 7 months out. Yeah. It's a wet pitch, weird environment, team that's kind of getting used to each other. A lot of new faces, and that's the pass you play within 10 minutes of coming on. It's an amazing bit of technique.
Yeah, great technique, and also confidence, because you can look an absolute fool if you splice that one.
That's what I'm thinking, because if you're coming back, then I think most players' instinct would be just to lay that off and to fluff up the accuracy percentages. But it's just not to be trite, but that's football.
We've all grown so sick of Pogba headlines on the back pages, haven't we, that you sometimes forget what a good footballer he is. And his long-range passing is great. His twinkle toes in tight areas is among the best around. So, yeah, he showed his class. And it is exciting, the prospect of him and Fernandes playing together. But it would take a McTominay or Fred out of the team. And against the very best teams, that might be a problem because, yeah, you lose a bit of that defensive nous there. I actually thought McTominay was really good.
It was, yeah, me too.
Yeah, I thought he stood out to me as being a player that's developed and grown. And McTominay right now is Manchester United's sort of defensive linchpin in there. And Fred has been playing well. Nothing wrong with Fred's form, but out of the two, I think, well, you saw, didn't you, with the substitution, I think McTominay is numero uno at the minute.
Mm-hmm. Do you think they might be a natural goal scorer short?
Manchester United, a natural goal scorer short. Possibly. I mean, Daniel James, you don't fancy to score a hatful, do you? Martial is a good finisher. I think Rashford is an excellent finisher. Are they a Harry Kane short? Is that where you're leading on this?
Yep.
I mean, there is a reason, isn't there, why United have been so interested in someone like Harry Kane. Yeah, he would be the icing on the cake of that potential forward line, wouldn't he? But look, for now, I think Manchester United are blessed with enough attacking firepower. I don't see it being a big problem. But yeah, perhaps as Roy Keane pointed out in his analysis, maybe they might be looking at changing the keeper. And I did talk about De Gea, didn't I? And I said he'll be a really important player for United because when he's at his best, he earns them wins when they draw. And when he's not at his best, and he hasn't been at his best for a long time, David De Gea, that's when United drop points. And look, but for that error, and it was an error, they would have won that game. And would be, you know, that would have been a terrific victory.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, Sheffield United, who are actually their next opponents, they look to have run out of a bit of a momentum. But Dean Henderson has really impressed me with them. And, you know, even he must have titanium wrists. You know, he's got such strong hands, isn't he? I think he's a fantastic goalkeeper. And I can see him becoming United's number one sooner rather than later.
I think the only thing that's going to be a problem there, Mike, is the size of David De Gea's contract. Because you cannot have a player's earning that kind of money sitting on the bench. It just doesn't work.
Welcome to modern football.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I just wonder also, I mean, obviously a couple of years ago, there was a substantial market for David De Gea. He could probably have had his pick of clubs, but you look around, Real Madrid are fully stocked. Barcelona obviously are not going to be moving on from Ter Stegen, nor should they. Neuber has gone to Bayern Munich to back up Manuel Neuer or replace him, one of the two. Wojciech Szczesny is doing good things at Juventus. I don't see many landing spots for David De Gea. So it's kind of, I don't know what United do with Dean Henderson, because is he going to, given the season he's had, and actually he has a very good shot of making the team of the season, I would say, does he accept another loan, or does he say, I want to move, I want to get on my career, I want some permanence? And I think he's entitled to make that demand. So it's difficult. I wouldn't like to have to make that decision.
Yeah, it's a good point.
It's difficult because I'd almost be tempted to, you know, if you're going to sell De Gea, I think you have to give him more time to reestablish himself. At the moment, you're not paying a lot of money for that goalkeeper in his form because he looks fragile and wounded. And actually, you know, I think this stretch of form goes all the way back to the 2018 World Cup.
Yeah.
So it's not just 6 weeks or something. It's quite substantial.
I agree. He's been making too many mistakes since. I just wonder, but Chelsea, they're not sure, are they, about Kepa? We've spoken about their ambition.
Nor should they be, Aid. Yeah. He needs replacing.
Yeah, well, could Henderson or David De Gea be a Chelsea goalkeeper sometime soon? You know, Manchester United, they can't have both because both have to be number ones somewhere.
Agree with that. We're starting to get a feel for what, I suppose, the new cliche, which is the new normal. I think what's become very clear, even on, you know, we've only had one round of fixtures, that some games just need an atmosphere. And I'm thinking of the Spurs-Man United game and obviously the Mersey Derby. You know, watching it, I gave artificial crowd noise a chance, but I've just had to bin it because It's such an inauthentic distraction to me, and it sort of matches the football, which is pretty neutered and muted. What about you?
I'm conflicted, really. I mixed it up. I watched Spurs Man United authentically, so I could hear the players and whatnot. It didn't.
You find out who the leaders are, don't you?
You do. And Hugo Lloris actually was really more vocal than I'd realised in terms of his screaming and shouting, particularly at corners and when balls were being played into the box. That was interesting. That was educational. Look, the crowd noise is fake. You all know it's fake. But for me, it still makes it just a little bit more palatable. For one reason or another, I've been working on the Arsenal games, and I've had to co-commentate in pure silence just for technical reasons. So when you have to co-commentate in pure silence, any kind of crowd noise, fake or otherwise, is welcome. Let me tell you, because it's really hard to get to not be detached from a game when you've got nothing in your ears. So no, I'm still conflicted. I haven't made my mind up yet, but if you've got it on, you've just got to accept that it's fake and ignore it, I guess, to some degree. It just stops it feeling like a training game for me. And that's the reason why I still would probably choose it.
Yeah, but it's funny. You do miss the sort of emotional intensity that a crowd brings, don't you? Because, I thought watching the BT Sport game, the Watford-Leicester game, you imagine that ground would have been in absolute ferment, wouldn't it, at the end? Because, you had that great Chilwell goal. Then you had, a central defender equalising in the 93rd minute. Oh, the place would have gone nuts. Yeah, great goals. And Craig Dawson, he looked nonplussed himself, didn't he, to be honest? But, the place would have gone absolutely nuts. And I do miss that, I have to say. Am I just being a, stick-in-the-mud purist, Seb?
No, I agree with you. It's, this is actually going to get harder as time goes on, because at the moment, these games have a consequence. People are actually playing to avoid relegation or to qualify for Europe. When we get into the dog days of mid-July and some of these teams have nothing to play for, you're going to miss it a whole lot more, because it's one of those compensations at the end of a season when, if you're not invested in the outcome of the game itself, then you can kind of take solace in the atmosphere and the environment and, all the sort of the dynamics that come with that. But it's, you guys talking about artificial noise. I've noticed variations between the channels. Now, I'm not just saying this because we're on BT programming, but what was the guy doing, the Merseyside derby doing? Like, there's a point in the second half.
He'd probably fallen asleep like the rest of us.
There was a point in the second half where Richarlison puts a shot, I think it was from about 30 yards out, puts a shot into orbit. And he's hit, I don't know if this is exactly how it works, but he's hit the goal button and the crowd starts cheering as if, like, you know the noise that a crowd makes just before a goalkeeper claws one out of his top corner?
Yeah, yeah.
He pressed that button.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it's heading towards the moon. It's going to land in Anfield, this shot. And it's just, fix up your game, Sky.
Yeah, you're at the mercy of your broadcast engineers, aren't you, here? You're pressing the right buttons.
I mean, I watch a lot of the NRL, and I know rugby's a simpler game to pipe noise into because it's territorial and a little bit more predictable, but the artificial noise there is excellent. And it is exactly as Aid describes it. It's a compensation. It helps you avoid that kind of training ground aesthetic that we're all trying to pretend isn't there. I don't know, it's hard. I mean, we said before we started recording that, like, a lot of the derby games are quite frantic and fractious. And when there's no atmosphere and when there's no noise in the stadium, you're just looking at bad football, really, aren't you? It's not an occasion and it's not a spectacle. It's just really football cranked up to 11 and in a really bad way.
I've been not every game. There's been some dog games like the Merseyside derby. I worked on the Brighton Arsenal game, and it was, if the crowd had been in there, I think they would have really enjoyed it. It was quite dramatic. The tempo was decent. I've been quite impressed, not massively, but quite impressed with the attitudes of the players and how they've coped with it. I think it's weirder for us, really, at the moment as viewers. But I just feel that we spoke when the pandemic started. I think we all said we fear that we're going to realise how vital fans are. What I hope will come of this is that we can find a way to get some supporters into grounds in September, maybe for the start of next season, particularly if the social distancing is eased to some degree. I do think there'll be a real clamour for clubs to find a way to get supporters in to generate an atmosphere, because yeah, football is just not the same.
Is there anything else, any other trends that you've spotted, Seb? You know, one thing that struck me was, you know, Dean Smith was saying after the Villa game yesterday that, you know, Chelsea or teams like Chelsea almost have an inherent advantage because they can, you know, because the depth of their squad is such that their five subs are going to be better than his five subs, basically. And therefore that can influence matches. Especially now, it's sort of the last quarter of a game. You're getting quite a few goals scored then, aren't you? And you know, games are being decided at that time, and they're being increasingly decided by the depth of the bench rather than anything else.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually, Mike, because as a manager, if you go into, let's say, the 60th minute and you're chasing the game, you can be really aggressive with your substitutions. You could put on three attacking players and then, you know, in an ordinary situation, you'd have to kind of couch a little bit and sort of defer to security. But because you've got an extra two, you can almost undo your own decision as and when the nature of the game changes. And I think I think the most successful teams, I mean, obviously squad depth is really important and the quality of players matters more than anything else. But I think this remaining 8-game period is going to reward managers who grasp this and who use that and exploit it to the fullest degree. Because for instance, if you were being hypercritical of Jose Mourinho on Friday night, you'd say you dallied with your substitutions, which is a strange thing to say about Mourinho, but you didn't bolster your midfield in a way that you could do with, you know, four other substitutions to spare. So that was really interesting. And I think, you know, the sort of the more tactically minded and the more kind of mentally agile managers are going to get a lot of currency out of this.
Yeah. You know, I mentioned Villa there, Aid. You know, if we look at the relegation fight, will Villa score enough goals to stay up? That's what struck me. And they needed to get something out of that Chelsea game, probably. And they play Newcastle on Wednesday night, and that seems pivotal now, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, it's going to be a very, very different type of match. I think it's easy to sort of think that when you see Chelsea having 74% of possession. I think a lot of teams might have looked like they were struggling to score goals against that type of opponent. Grealish will come to the fore in matches where Villa have a more even share of possession. On that Chelsea game, by the way, brilliant tactics from Lampard in exploiting that right-hand side, basically pushing Azpilicueta on, saying, OK, Grealish, what do you want to do? Are you going to cheat or are you going to come with me? And unfortunately, Jack didn't always come with him, and Azpilicueta ended up being the match winner for Chelsea. So that was really smart of Lampard, I thought. Will Villa score enough goals? I do think they put good balls into the box. We saw that with their goal. El Ghazi is a good deliverer. So is Jack Grealish. John McGinn has got a good left foot. And they can get Samatta going. He's a powerful player in the air. Keenan Davis has got potential.
I quite like Keenan Davis.
Yeah, I like him.
He's a real unit.
He's a real unit. But he's
technically a good player too. Yeah. Like, he's got some really nice touches.
He has. But there's nothing proven about him, is there, at this level?
No.
So it's a gamble. When you're in the middle of a relegation battle, it's who do you pick? Do you pick the promising kid that might turn out to be a worldie, or do you go with someone that you spent big money on for a reason? So, no, I think Villa, yeah, they can score enough goals. It's, yeah, I still feel that they've got a fighting chance of survival. I really do, because they have got Jack Grealish and McGinn, who can make the difference.
By contrast, Seb, Norwich sadly look doomed, don't they? Very, very strangely submissive performance on their first game back, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was talking to a friend of mine during the game on WhatsApp, and he's from a family of Norwich fans, and he kind of predicted it. He said, oh, you know, there's a collapse coming. I can't get through one of these podcasts without losing my voice, can I? Just every time. I said at half-time to him, you know, they kept the ball quite nicely. They perhaps miss a bit of presence at the top of the pitch, but there's something encouraging about kind of the phase of their play. And he's like, no, you know, because it seems to be like a fundamental weakness and a lack of something, which I can't even define, because it was almost a surrender. And you just thought, this relegation fight is close enough for, you know, a couple of wins, and all of a sudden the picture completely changes. I mean, look how it might have looked had Villa held on to their lead at halftime on Sunday. They'd have been out of the relegation spots. They'd have been up to 16th. And it's almost as if Norwich, I don't believe that they're not good enough, Mike, because I see some of these players, and yeah, there are a few deficiencies in the squad, but I look at someone like Todd Cantwell or Max Ahrens. I think you're really good players. You can make a difference in some of these games. Mm. And they were turned over so easily by, with no disrespect intended, a team like Southampton, really? Mm. I mean, that just doesn't...
Naive, weren't they? I mean, I just thought tactical naivety. Yeah.
I know soft is a media term rather than a player's term, but that's how it looked. Some of those goals were awfully soft. They didn't look like a team that kind of wanted to, you know, go out swinging a few punches. It was one of the strangest games I've seen since the restart, actually.
I just think that they were... Talk about having a soft centre. I mean, Southampton could stride down the middle whenever the play broke down at absolute will. So if that happens once or twice, surely a manager has to respond to that and say that doesn't happen again and make some adjustments either in terms of the personnel in central midfield or to change the shape or to get messages there in terms of we're too flimsy down the spine of the pitch. It didn't happen. And yeah, I just feel that they're a bit too idealist, really, in terms of their philosophy, Daniel Farker and Norwich, and it will cost them because they're just not good enough at the back to have a framework ahead of them that is flimsy.
Do you think that if they had their time again, they might invest in someone who, for want of a better description, kicked people a little bit? I think there's a few too many artisans in that first 11. There's a few too many nice players who, you know, are very pretty to watch, but there isn't quite enough menace to them in the same way that someone like, you know, Watford has some good players as well, but also, you know, Watford will fight you if you want them to. And I don't get that same feeling from Norwich. And I know it's a little bit of an anachronism, but I feel that's still quite an important quality in relegation football.
It's just those nicey Stanglians, isn't it? That's where you're going with this, isn't it? You know,
I suppose another gauge of it, and I think you touched on it, Seb, where if you look at that team and, you know, when the autopsy is performed, you know, in a few weeks' time, players will be taken out of that squad. You know, there'll be four or five players who look natural Premier League players, probably in better Premier League teams. Whereas Bournemouth, you maybe take a couple of players out, David Brooks, King, perhaps, Aki. You know, there are a few there. But I thought, again, Bournemouth were so submissive at the weekend. They've got Wolves next, and I shudder to think what they'll do to that defence. 8 points out of 39. That's relegation form in anyone's language, isn't it?
Big time, big time. It's a scary time as well because you know, 82% of that revenue does come from Premier League broadcasting contracts. I also don't understand it, Mike. I thought we'd get a little bit of a retaliation from Bournemouth. Having David Brooks back is hugely important. It should have been a big lift to that entire attacking unit, which has been so barren throughout the season. I think they've only scored 28 goals, something like that. It's won a game, basically, or less than now because they didn't score against Palace. I was shocked by how easily they were dismantled. And again, it's almost like the Norwich criticism, Mike. You didn't see some of the kind of, you know, some of the intangibles that you look for in a team that's willing to fight for its future. It looked like, again, another surrender. They were handily beaten. It was far too easy.
Yeah, and I suppose the other thing that struck me was looking at Eddie Howe on the touchline. He had that 1,000-yard stare, didn't he? And it was like, wow, you know, he's obviously, because he's a very diligent, intelligent, you know, a very, very good guy to talk football with. So he's obviously been churning around this issue on a 24/7 basis for probably too long. He looks lost.
Yeah, I can understand why you would say that. He's in a pickle, clearly. Yeah, that 1,000-yard stare is becoming commonplace, really, with Eddie. He knows his football. He knows his football. He's a very good coach. Like you say, he's probably working harder now than he ever has. But maybe sometimes when you've been there a while, you can't see the wood for the trees. I know it's an old cliche, but you can't see the big picture clearly. Maybe what Eddie needs to do, if he's going to stay there, is bring in someone new into his backroom team just to have fresh eyes on it, because it feels like they've gone very stale when I think of Bournemouth at their best, it's when they're breaking up pace, slipping those early balls down the channels for Josh King, for Callum Wilson. And they're just not doing that anymore. And aside from David Brooks, they don't have any imagination. They don't have any creativity. I think only one team creates fewer chances in open play than Bournemouth. And that's not what Bournemouth were built on under Eddie Howe. So, yeah, confidence, I think, has been sapped from the players because of results. And maybe the manager as well is starting to, I think, I don't know if I've got the right answers here. It is worrying times for Bournemouth. Look, right now, to me, it seems that Norwich are definitely going to go down because of their tactical naivety, and that Bournemouth, because of their form and confidence, will go down, and the rest are battling for the final spot.
Yeah, so if you say Villa, you know, we've all already talked about West Ham's, you know, basically being pretty insipid. So if you think those four are going to, basically the three are going to come from those four, what about Watford? They look to have the required durability to stay up, don't they? And that's probably an indication of how well Nigel Pearson has done.
Yeah, I think so. No, I think they should have won that game as well. They had a couple of really good chances. You know, save that Chilwell banger, they probably would have got 3 points eventually. I thought they were the better team. But that turnover has been amazing because Pearson didn't just inherit a team that wasn't defending well, wasn't attacking with the right ratios. He inherited a dressing room within which there's quite a lot of disharmony and quite a few players that didn't actually want to be there. And I don't think we need to name them. I think that was pretty self-evident. And I've been really impressed by the kind of the spirit that's re-emerged since he joined the club. And I like them to get out of it. I think what we've got to look at in this situation is coaching ability. You know, Pearson and Shakespeare there, that's an excellent team. Also been through a relegation survival before. Also look at harmony. And one of the reasons why we doubt West Ham and why we're kind of disparaging about them is because they don't have that. They have all the quality in the world. They spent an absolute fortune on this squad. And yet it adds up to far less than the sum of its parts because you have these dressing room problems that someone like Nigel Pearson has been able to cure, seemingly. So that's the difference.
You paid special attention to Brighton, Aid. They were at Leicester on Tuesday, funny enough. That win over Arsenal had the air of being a decisive win. Is that fair?
Well, it's massive for their confidence. And it could be the difference. Hand on heart and taking my Arsenal tinted spectacles off, they were fortunate to win the game. I mean, Arsenal controlled it and had more than enough chances to bury them before that turnaround. But what I'll credit is that they never gave up Brighton. They showed real spirit in the second half. Graham Potter shook things up. I think he made a smart change at half time. Took off Aaron Moy, who was a good player. But he was being ineffective because of the shape of the Arsenal team. So he brought on a Solly March, who can operate as a wing back of sorts when necessary, and that was good. And he went two up top at the right time with Connolly and Mopay, and we saw that pay off in spades with the winner, and that winning goal.
What a goal!
Yeah, what a goal! I mean, that was sparkling. Front two football.
Excellent.
You work on those on the training ground
week
in, week out, but very rarely do they actually come off. Ball into the centre forward, he dummies it, second player gets it, spins, little flick. It was absolutely glorious football, as poor as Arsenal defended it and as slow as they were to react to it. So no, it will lift their morale, no question. But I wasn't that impressed by Brighton. The one thing that frustrated me as an Arsenal follower, but would encourage me as a Seagulls fan, is that they were dirty. They really got their foot in, and there was nothing meek about Brighton. I mean, Yves Bissouma, I think, had seven fouls, and he didn't get a yellow. As far as I'm concerned, he got away with murder. But they were putting their foot in, and that I think is something that you rightly pointed out is lacking at Norwich. So that there was fight about the Seagulls, and that would encourage me.
Does that differ? You know, let's differentiate between that type of aggression and the perceived aggression in the Morpay incident with Leno, where, you know, to me, looking at it, it looked to be a football accident. Do you agree with that?
I think so. I mean, I don't really see the difference between what happened between Leno and Morpay and a couple of minutes later, Alexander Lacazette sliding in to block a Matt Ryan clearance and leaving his foot in. The difference is that Matt Ryan didn't get hurt. Also, I mean, I point people towards David Priest's analysis, obviously longtime friend of the show and all-round good man. David said, and he's obviously a professional goalkeeping coach, he said that that's not the way goalkeepers are taught to protect themselves when they're in the air, not the way they're taught to land. I'm not going to go as far as to say that I blame Bernd Leno for getting hurt. My pay goes into the Arsenal dressing room at halftime, seeks out Mikel Arteta and apologises. I don't believe for a second he tried to hurt the goalkeeper. I'm not sure what else he's supposed to do. I mean, everyone's best wishes are with Leno. It's just really unfortunate.
Yeah, I agree that it was an accident. He definitely didn't mean to hurt him. But what more could he do is not go for the ball, because both hands were on the ball. And you've seen Neil Mopé. He's not a big guy.
No.
He was never, ever going to win the ball. So what he has to do, and this is a lesson for him and for other strikers, is to just give up on that and just say, because it wasn't a 50-50. He had the ball. He was in midair. He was in the process of claiming the ball, yet he jumped into him. I thought it was reckless. And I'm not saying that he deserves to be, you know, slated to kingdom come for this. It certainly didn't mean to hurt him, but it was reckless. And I think that it just goes to show, you know, how easily footballers can get injured. Personally, you know, I know Bernd Leno is a relatively mild character, and you could see his anger when he was being carried off. It wasn't because he knew he went to get him. It was because it was the silliest of token attempts to get the ball. And that token attempt to get the ball has led to what I think could be a very serious knee injury. So let's not let him off the hook completely.
Do you know what it made me think of, Aid? Is the incident between Manuel Neuer and Gonzalo Higuain in the 2014 World Cup final. Mm. Now, I agree with a lot of what you say, but then I also think there's no way someone like Neil Maupay does that to a Manuel Neuer. If he tries to do that, he gets flattened. And I'm kind of more inclined to sort of defer to David Priest's analysis, just because it makes sense to me. Like, forwards do this. It's part of the game. It's almost an instinct, it seems. And I think I kind of want my forward going for that goal, for that ball. I want the goalkeeper, as with, you know, when he's trying to claim a cross or a corner or a free kick, I want his life to be as awkward as possible. I don't want him getting hurt, but I want that competitiveness and I want to see it. And I you know, you wish Bernd Leno well, and, you know, I hope it's not as serious as it looks, of course. Yeah. You know, it sounds like
in
it
a
is,
different
but,
scenario, yeah. I'd agree. I think if he has a genuine chance of scoring a goal, scoring a goal, it was more
fine
of a 50-50. I think there, the ball was running towards the edge of the box. The keeper's clearly going to get the ball. It was an unnecessary challenge, if you want to call it that. It was completely unnecessary. The whole, he had every right to go for that argument, doesn't hold sway in this instance, although I agree with it in general that strikers should be able to go in for 50-50s with keepers. Here, there was... I just didn't see what there was to gain, but there you go.
Okay, well, let's try and pull things together now, and I hope you don't mind me imposing on you for this one, Aid. For your thought for the day, could you just give us your thoughts about Arsenal and the state of Arsenal at the moment? By common consent, they've had a terrible restart. You know, there are all sorts of personality issues. Guendouzi is one case in point. Looks like he's going to get probably a 3-match ban. Where are Arsenal going?
Well, yeah, everything that could have gone wrong is going wrong. You know, major injuries to three key players in the part of the pitch you don't want injuries. You know, Leno, Xhaka and Mari. You've probably got your best keeper, your best centre-half on form, and your best central midfielder, your most reliable central midfielder, all injured. So that's a blow. Where are Arsenal? I think the last two matches prove that if you don't have a solid defensive platform, you aren't going to succeed. And they just keep losing concentration. I don't believe it's coaching. I believe it's a personnel issue. And that the personnel, the defensive, the players in central midfield and at the back are not quite up to standard, in my opinion, the vast majority of them. And that is where the revolution needs to take place. I think Arteta needs to be ruthless and replace and upgrade and instill the right habits. He's trying. I trust in Mikel Arteta to do the right things. I think he's trying to get the right messages across, but the defensive platform is not there. Concentration lapses. They can't continue to haunt Arsenal in this way. And yeah, Arsenal should have won that game 2-3 nil. Yet they somehow conspired to concede twice. One from a short corner where Pepe turns his back on it and jogs back into the box. Lacazette's on his heels, doesn't see the 2v1 early enough. Bang, it's a goal. The second one is great forward play, but at the same time, no communication between the centre halves. There's a disconnect there. I think you could point towards them. And also actually the goalkeeper for coming off his line. I think he stays put. It's a much harder finish for Neil Mopay. So look, I just think in defensive areas, Arsenal need better players. Simple as that.
Spoken with feeling.
Yeah, I'm afraid is only part of the issue. But for now, that's enough.
Okay, Seb, what do you want to get off your chest?
I just want to give a little bit of shout out to my friends at Weymouth. I've got a huge amount of time for the work that Mark Moseley's done there and everyone at the club. And they are the National League South and National League North has agreed to a playoff tournament to finish their respective seasons. But the clubs are going to have to bear the cost of all the testing kits and the provisions needed for the restart. And they've got a GoFundMe going and they're trying to raise £50,000. And they've made, I think, they're up to about 9,000 in 36 hours. And I spoke to Mark yesterday, and as he said, his players deserve the right to compete. So if you've got a National League South or North club near you who are doing the same thing, I'm sure there's lots of these going on in the country, then do try and help out, because there's an awful lot of work that goes on to get these clubs to this point of the season. They need to finish it.
Yeah, I agree with that. It seems terrible that clubs are almost... Well, they're penalised for success, aren't they?
Surely the league... The sponsors, the FA, if they want these competitions to be completed, surely they can chip in here. I mean, it seems incredibly harsh for the clubs to fund it themselves. That's too much of an ask. Of course they want to play. You got to make it easy for them.
There's going to be a lot of the schedule is going to change. I think the dynamics of the game are going to change. And look, I know it's hard to say this after such a long time without football, but no one benefits if the game resembles one of those marathon dance contests of the Great Depression. You know, I think hard decisions need to be taken because there are too many conflicting demands on both the clubs and especially the players. Now, understandably, there's a lot of focus on the future of the League Cup. There's some talk that there's a move for it to be played without 7 Premier League teams next season. Well, that's the thin end of the wedge, isn't it? And as it stands, it looks to me to be a superfluous competition in need of, real renewal. What would I do? I'd turn it into a true EFL Cup, unlike that unloved dumping ground for B teams that's been rejected out of hand by the fans. I'd be interested in your views. Do you agree with me? And I also hope you've enjoyed today's show. And thanks once again for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc. Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.